Good evening. We'll go ahead and get started. A few miscellaneous things on the announcement front. You'll be getting your CE letters when you finish the program. One of the unintended side effects of recording it so that if you miss a session, you can complete it via distance education and so on, is we don't necessarily know when you finish the program. If you do all the sessions and take the post-test for any you're not physically here for, we know you're done and we'll send you the CE letter. Particularly for distance ed folks, if you haven't done all 10 post-tests, we figure you're not done yet. If you want your CE letter before that, if you're only going to do, you know, 5 post-tests because you only need that many hours of credit or whatever, all you need to do is let us know. And if you need CE documentation partway through, again, all you need to do is let us know. But remember, you know, if you're physically here in person, you need to write it down or else we won't retain it. And if, obviously, if you're not here in person, you need to email us or leave us a voicemail. You'll also be getting links to an evaluation. We do evaluations separately for each of the topics and special topics. And a reminder, if you haven't gotten around to doing your evaluation for any of the previous terms, please go ahead and do it. You know, a late evaluation is better than no evaluation. The feedback is useful. You know, the various CE authorities want us to report on evaluations, so on. So we really would like people to go ahead and do their evaluations. There was some interest last time in consultation or coming up with some sort of online consultation group. As far as I know, we don't have a group of people who can agree on scheduling to do the online consultation. Should there be a group of people interested in doing that, just get in touch with me. One thing to keep in mind is, as alumni of the program, you can continue participating in the Google group. And not only can you ask questions about content stuff there, but you can also raise clinical questions in the consultation, in the Google group, and use that as a form of consultation. And a fringe benefit of completing the program is you get to keep doing that as far into the future as we're running this program. So that's an option you've got. Also, for people who aren't in the Cleveland area, if you want to arrange in-person supervision, you may well be able to find an appropriate supervisor by checking the Academy of Cognitive Therapy's listing of certified consultants and trainers, or by consulting the ABCT directory to see who is in your neck of the woods, and there may well be a senior person in your neck of the woods who would be available for consultation. Any questions from last time, from the readings from the popular press before we get into tonight's topic? Okay, tonight we're on anger. You know, when we start off on a given topic, we usually review the DSM criteria for the relevant diagnosis because that's a usual, useful way to organize things. With anger, it's a little different because DSM doesn't have as good a set of diagnostic categories for anger problems as it does in most problem areas. I'm not actually sure why that is. It seems like the people who write DSM would be, you know, aware of the various problems with anger that people have. But for whatever reason, we have a few diagnoses like intermittent explosive disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, etc. But it's not a very comprehensive set when you think of all the various problems with anger that clients run into. The most obvious, you know, kind of problem is when somebody gets really angry over something small, and this is problematic for them, and that may well meet criteria for intermittent explosive disorder. But that's by no means the only problem with anger people run into. If you think about the people in your caseload, you know, there are some people where, you know, it's not so much dramatically overreacting to something tiny, but they're irritable and quick-tempered, and they get aggravated about mundane stuff a lot more than is necessary. Or you've got people who, you know, get angry about stuff that would get the average person angry, but they express their anger in dysfunctional ways or in ineffective ways. You've got all the people who can't deal effectively with situations involving anger and conflict, either because they don't have the skills to be appropriately assertive or because they're so afraid of conflict that they avoid. You've got the people who get angry and then don't get over it. They hold a grudge. They come up with this laundry list of all the other aggravating things the other party has ever done and spend a lot more time being angry about stuff than is necessary. You've got all the clients who get angry at themselves and spend a lot of time giving themselves a hard time and punishing themselves. And one of the least obvious, but it's fairly common in my caseload, is all the people who avoid conflict and suppress anger to the best of their ability. Now, some of those people hold things in as long as possible and then get to the point where they can't take it anymore and overreact to something, and we've got intermittent explosive disorder. But there are many other people who suppress anger and avoid conflict, and they never explode over anything. They either end up having somatic symptoms, or they get depressed, or they lose interest in sex, or they, quote, fall out of love. I've had a variety of clients over the years where the complaint is they've fallen out of love. And usually it turns out they've been suppressing anger and resentment for, you know, 5-10 years. And then voila, they find themselves not feeling very affectionate towards their partner. Is this any surprise? Well, it's a surprise to them. They didn't realize it was going to turn out that way. You know, or you've got the people who suppress anger and avoid conflict, and it manifests in passive-aggressive behavior. And for better or worse, we don't have good diagnostic categories for all these different anger problems, but they're all completely legit problems. They're all problems we can be real helpful with, and we may need to spend some time thinking, okay, how do I code this on the insurance form? But generally, you know, a person who has a clinical level of these various problems is going to have symptoms in some domain. They're going to qualify. They may qualify for a depression diagnosis or an anxiety diagnosis or a relationship issue diagnosis. But often a big part of their problem is dealing with anger.
I notice a lot of people with a borderline personality disorder tend to talk about a lot, kind of losing their temper and blowing things out of proportion.
Yeah. And people with borderline personality disorder is rather notorious for dramatic overreactions to things that, you know, might hurt the average person's feelings, might be aggravating, but feel like an enormous deal to the borderline client. And we can get into that a little bit more down the road. But if you think back to borderline personality disorder, one thing that comes up there is black and white thinking, which pushes one to the extremes in emotional reactions. Another thing that's real common there is the fear of being rejected, which often plays out into, I don't dare express any anger because that's going to get me rejected and abandoned. And so the person holds it in as long as possible and then eventually gets to a point where they can't take it anymore and they react dramatically. And I have to look at DSM to make sure I've got the criteria right. The behavior pattern is like intermittent explosive disorder. But I think when somebody has borderline personality disorder, you know, it just falls under that umbrella rather than getting a separate diagnosis of intermittent explosive disorder as well. And that one part of DSM's challenge in figuring out how to do categories for this is there are a lot of different diagnostic categories where one difficulty with anger or another is part of the package. People with paranoid personality disorder often are angry and have a lot of interpersonal conflict. People with dependent personality disorder often have an incredible difficulty being assertive, etc. And if the person's problems with anger, you know, fall under some other diagnosis they've got, that's often the way it gets coded, at least for insurance purposes. Now, why do people have so much trouble dealing with anger? One way to understand an individual's problems with anger is to just use our standard approach, take specific problem situations one at a time, and walk through what was the situation, what led up to it, how was the person feeling, what thoughts were running through their head, what did they do then, etc. And that actually works just fine clinically if we're doing an individualized one person at a time approach. A good example, and this connects back to borderline personality disorder. When we talked about borderlines, I used my case example of Jane, who's sitting at home being depressed, not accomplishing a whole lot. Her husband comes home from work and remarks that, gee, doesn't seem like she got a lot done today. And her immediate reaction inside her head is to think, I don't deserve this. And she feels angry at her husband. But she's also afraid that if she says or does the wrong thing, her husband will get mad at her. And they have a long history of major arguments and the police being called to their apartment and so on. So she also has a thought, here we go again. She's anticipating it, cascading into that in one of their major arguments. She's afraid of her husband's reaction. So she doesn't speak up, in semi-reasonable ways. The average person might well say, of course I didn't get much done today. I'm in a major depression, you idiot. And it would not explode the way it does for her. But instead, she suppresses all that. And for most people, when you suppress anger, it doesn't just evaporate anything. First of all, the other party keeps doing whatever it is that bugs you, and the emotions tend to build up. But also, one thing that complicates it for Jane is she's real prone to self-criticism and self-blame, so she starts thinking thoughts like, I never do anything right, and she's feeling a lot of guilt and self-blame. She starts thinking, I'm a useless, worthless person. She starts having suicidal impulses. She starts pleading with her husband not to be mad at her. He claims that he's not mad at her. She doesn't believe him. He can see where this is going. He doesn't want to have another one of their knockdown, drag-out arguments, so he tries to just leave the room so things can calm down. She follows him, pleading with him not to be angry. And after moving from room to room a few times, he finally gets fed up and crabs at her, which seems to her to prove that he was angry all along. And then she yells back at him, and he yells back at her, and in half an hour, the police are being called to their apartment again. And, we can see that there's certainly automatic thoughts play a role in anger problems, but that's not by no means all that's going on here. And one piece of it is anger is a problem that usually occurs in an interpersonal context, and the relationship and how the other party responds plays an important role in anger problems. But there's more to it than that. If you go to the handouts, first of all, on the first page of the handouts, we have some additional resources. But on page 2 of the handouts, one thing is that our upbringing has a big impact on how we handle anger and whether we handle it in reasonably appropriate ways that work out reasonably well or if we handle it in ways that turn out badly. And one level of it is what our parents explicitly teach us. I had a nice middle class upbringing, and I was taught to be nice to people. I grew up in a blue collar neighborhood where most of my compatriots were not particularly taught to be nice. They were taught to stand up for themselves. They were not taught to not let anybody push them around. Had some interesting repercussions over the course of my childhood. But in addition to what our parents explicitly teach us, we humans learn a lot from the examples around us. And the way our parents handle anger is something we also learn a lot from, and it may or may not match what they tell us about how to handle anger. for example, in the family you grew up in the school you grew up in, you know, what happened if a kid broke the rules? What happened if a kid didn't do what they were supposed to? What happened if a parent was in a bad mood? Well, it varies from family to family and school to school. But for a heck of a lot of people, you know, their experience in the course of growing up is, if I do the wrong thing, if I break the rules, if I'm aggravating, you know, people get mad at me, they yell at me, they punish me. And this is supposed to make me change my ways and, you know, not do that again. It's supposed to make me remember to take the trash out when I'm supposed to and do it without being reminded, etc. And one of the non-obvious things we're learning in that situation is the thing to do if somebody's bad is get mad at them and punish them. The thing to do if somebody doesn't do what they're supposed to is get mad at them and punish them. The thing to do if somebody breaks the rules is get mad at them and punish them. The thing to do if I'm upset with somebody is to get mad at them and punish them. And I'm learning that lesson from my parents' example, from my teacher's example, whether or not that matches the words they're using. You know, and often, well-intended parents are oblivious to what they're teaching their kids. When my kids were in fifth and sixth grade, you know, at that particular school, there was a place by the sidewalk with a sign, don't stop to drop your kids off here, drop your kids off down there. And there was this nice line of middle-class parents in their cars pulling up to that sign, stopping and dropping their kids off where it says, don't drop your kids off here. And I'm willing to bet if we stopped and interviewed those parents, they weren't intending to teach their kids it's fine to ignore the rules when obeying the rules is inconvenient to you. But that was the example they were setting. You know, and if they had stopped and thought about it, wait a minute, do I really want to teach my kids to ignore the rules when obeying the rules is inconvenient? No, this is going to be a pain in the butt at home if my kids get that lesson from my behavior. But that's what they were doing. And so one important piece of, you know, the difficulties people run into in handling anger, one line of questioning that's real useful is, how is anger handled in your family as you were growing up? And often it turns out simple and straightforward. The person sitting in front of me is, to a large extent, copying the examples they grew up with. You know, if dad, you know, when he had a rough day, came home, threw a tantrum and smashed the TV, the person sitting in front of me may well have a very similar problem. You know, if, you know, when mom was upset, she yelled and swore and threw things, it's not at all surprising if the person in front of me does something very similar. And so one of my usual suspects for anger problems is this person just copying the example they grew up with? That's very understandable. You know, that's how we humans learn a lot of stuff. One thing that's less obvious but equally powerful is if I grow up in a family where one or both parents are a bad example of how to handle anger, do I have any good examples of how to handle anger? And one thing that has often an even bigger impact on people is they don't have a clue how to handle anger well because when they were growing up, there was nobody in their family who talked calmly and reasonably when they were upset. There was nobody in their family who took a little while to calm down and then, you know, tried to deal with things reasonably. You know, and it's much harder to learn skills when you don't have an example to work from. You know, take something reasonably straightforward like learning how to cook. Have you ever tried to learn how to cook just from reading the recipe? You know, if you have, you've discovered how hard that is. You know, wait a minute, it says saute. What the hell do they mean by that? You know, and if I can watch somebody and use the recipe, it's a lot easier to understand what is intended. It's a lot easier to master the skills. I discover, oh, there's a lot of things that's presumed in the recipe and not actually mentioned. You know, if I happen to grow up in a family where I don't have a whole lot of good examples, or a community where I don't have a whole lot of good examples, that makes it a whole lot harder to learn how to handle anger well. And one of the things that tends to come up in good old middle-class American culture is, what's your average middle-class couple do when they're angry with each other? Well, the norm in our culture is you don't fight in front of the kids. You know, you go, you know, somewhere behind a closed door after you think the kids are asleep, and then you hash things out. Now, if you're lousy at handling anger, the soundproofing isn't nearly as good as you think it is. The kids are lying there awake at night hearing the fight, and stresses them out, upsets them, and they learn new words and poor skills for handling conflict. But if it's a couple that's absolutely fine at handling conflict, they go behind closed doors, they talk things over calmly and reasonably, they express feelings, they respect each other's feelings, they negotiate it, etc., the kids don't have a chance to learn from that. Because that's not nearly as loud. The soundproofing is good enough so the kids don't hear that. And so that the kids don't have the chance to learn those skills because they're not around to observe when their parents handle conflict well. Now, they still may get adequate exposure to the skills on the occasions where the parents are upset with the kids. On the other hand, if the kids also upset, they may not be doing their best listening and observing while that's going on. So you can also grow up in a family where the parents have perfectly fine skills, but the kids don't master them, you know, because of these sorts of factors. Another important piece of learning in the family is, what are the consequences of my actions? If I grow up in a family where the rule is no TV till your homework's done, but it's enforced inconsistently, and I can get away with not doing my homework if my parents are in a good mood or if I come up with a good excuse, etc. You know, I'm not learning effective ways to discipline kids, so this may be a challenge when I've got my own kids, and I'm learning that I don't need to take the rules seriously because they're not enforced. You know, so we can have an additional level of complications there. There are also important cultural influences on how anger is handled. You know, I was a middle-class kid growing up in a blue-collar neighborhood. You know, most of my friends, when they got to be somewhere around 6 or 7, you know, somebody was mean to them on the playground. They ran home crying, and Dad took them out in the backyard, taught them how to make a fist, taught them how to punch, and taught them not to take any shit from anybody. And they're being taught explicitly that when you're angry, the thing to do is to be violent. You know, I didn't get that memo. I was in a middle-class family where they didn't teach us that, and it took me a long time to realize that I needed to stand up for myself physically if I didn't want to get picked on. I was a slow learner. And the norms for how to handle anger and conflict vary a lot from culture to culture and within cultures. And this can have a big impact. You've got the explicit messages, you know, things like stand up for yourself, don't let anybody push you around, don't get mad, get even, be a man, with the implication that being a man somehow involves violence, you know, and a big emphasis on the importance of respect, with the subtext that the way to get respected is to intimidate the other person. You know, and we grow up with various messages around us, and we sort of just take them in by osmosis without even particularly thinking about it. There's also the glorification of violent sports, the glorification of violent figures in the media. Not just mainstream U.S. culture. Along the border, there's a long tradition of Hispanic songs glorifying drug traffickers. You know, okay, this is not the world's best influence. You know, we got the wrestling and mixed martial arts. And one of the areas that's had a lot of controversy is, you know, to what extent do violent video games and so on have impacts on behavior. I think there's movement towards a consensus saying, yeah, this does have some impact. One of the things that I think has a big impact is both movies, video games, popular songs, and so on, often portray violence without realistically portraying the consequences of violence. And so it ends up seeming like a much bigger deal, a much better deal than it is. You know, Rambo whips out a machine gun, shoots everybody up, and A, he doesn't end up rotting in jail for the rest of his life. He doesn't end up with PTSD. You know, you don't have all his victims and their survivors of his victims suffering from it. So it's a lot easier for people not to grasp the impact their actions have on others, not to grasp the impact that their own actions are going to have on themselves. How's all this sound so far? Questions or comments so far? Now, on the cognitive level, you know, we've got the good old automatic thoughts. And one of the things that, sort of Beck's category for the thoughts that generate anger is what he calls intrusions on personal domain, which is not the most rolling smoothly off one's tongue terminology, but it's basically, you know, he took my stuff, he's stopping me from doing what I want. Yeah, okay, those sorts of scenarios do tend to, you know, be upsetting. You know, I can buy that. But an important chunk of it on the automatic thought level is the sense that what's happening not only is something I dislike, but also it's unfair, it's unreasonable, it's unjustified. If somebody takes my stuff and it seems justified, I'm not going to like it, but I'm not going to be nearly as angry as if somebody takes my stuff and it seems unjustified. For example, if I don't pay my car payment and my car gets repossessed, I'm going to be upset, but I'm not going to be nearly as angry as if somebody steals my car. And one category of thoughts we do a lot is make attributions about why the person did what they did. And if a person's actions seem to be malicious, that tends to generate a lot more anger. If it seems to show disrespect, that tends to generate a lot more anger, particularly in blue-collar and inner-city populations. The tougher the neighborhood is, the more important respect is, typically. But it also varies some regionally. Respect is a much bigger deal in the South. So you get interesting cultural differences. And obviously, the usual crop of cognitive distortions can then amplify the impact of automatic thoughts. Dichotomous thinking is going to result in a lot more intense reactions. Overgeneralize, he always does that. You know, it's going to generate a stronger reaction. Catastrophizing, imagine how serious the consequences will be if this keeps happening, generates a stronger reaction. Another set of cognitions that we haven't talked about as much as some others is our expectations, both our expectations as regarding how the other person is going to respond to what I say and do. And they are expectations about how our various alternatives will play out, make a big difference in which options we choose. And my expectations may or may not be realistic. If I'm thinking, you know, James is a good example. One of her beliefs was nobody will take me seriously unless I'm in crisis. So she had a long history of not speaking up unless she was really, really upset. And she was honestly convinced that if she spoke up calmly and reasonably, nobody would take her seriously. Of course, she couldn't remember the last time she tried speaking up calmly and reasonably. And after, you know, a couple sessions of persuasion, I finally got her to try speaking up calmly and reasonably, and she was amazed to discover that her husband took her seriously and responded without them getting into an enormous fight. You know, totally amazed her. She was absolutely certain that nobody would take her seriously if she wasn't incredibly upset. Yeah. We've also got the beliefs and assumptions level. And, you know, one set that makes it has a big impact is all our conditional beliefs. And particularly some of our beliefs about what the person's behavior means. You know, one that comes up for a reasonable amount of my practice is the idea that if somebody criticizes me, that means they don't respect me. Or the idea that if I don't demand respect, then people will just take advantage of me more, they'll just attack me more. You know, or for couples, the idea that if my partner doesn't spontaneously know what I want and do it without me asking, that shows that they don't love me. If somebody loves you, they'll know what you want and do it without you having to ask. So if they don't, you know, this proves they don't love you. That makes it a much bigger deal. And also, if I believe that, you know, if she loved me, she'd know what I wanted and do it without me asking, I'm not going to bother asking. Because if I ask and she does it because I ask, that doesn't show that she loved me. If she loved me, I wouldn't have to ask. You know, if getting married granted one ESP, this would work out just fine. You know, but how many people have a good batting average in always anticipating what their spouse wants? Another category of thoughts that has an important impact is all the shoulds we carry around with us. There are sets of rules. And, you know, things like, my kids should respect me. And implying this is supposed to just happen automatically without me needing to do anything to establish the respect. You know, the idea from a moment ago that my spouse should know what I want without me having to ask. The idea that life should be fair. All the unwritten contracts we carry around in our head. If I do X, the other person should do Y. And sometimes it's simple, obvious stuff. Hey, if I invite them over for dinner, they should invite us over for dinner. And sometimes it's much less obvious stuff. And, you know, if the other party had a very similar upbringing, they may share the same assumptions and this may not be a problem. But if the other person had a somewhat different upbringing and is from a somewhat different culture, they may have very different assumptions about how one should handle different situations. You know, I grew up in the Deep South, and where we lived, you know, it was the norm was if you're friends with somebody, you just drop by unannounced. And that shows how good friends you are. You know, you only call ahead if this is a formal, more business relationship rather than a friend relationship. My mom grew up in the Northeast where you never dropped by unannounced. That was incredibly rude. You know, if you cared about somebody, you called ahead. And she never did come to terms with that one. You know, she was constantly offended that people dropped by unannounced when they thought they were doing something nice by dropping by unannounced. You know, another important aspect here, you know, and I think, you know, there's a lot going on with anger problems, is the behavioral strategies, the interpersonal strategies we have. How do you get a kid to be good? How do you get somebody to respect you? How do you get treated fairly? And my bet is, if you step the average American on the street corner and ask, how do you get a kid to be good? The most common answer is going to be, well, the way to get a kid to be good is to punish them when they're bad. Which has some important side effects. That means if I want to get this kid to be good, I need to be on the lookout for bad behavior because I can't punish it if I don't spot it. And then when I spot it, I need to punish it. Now, for all the kids who respond to punishment by not doing that anymore, this works out just fine. It's not an inherently dysfunctional idea. But think of the kids you grew up with. You know, did all your friends and associates respond to punishment in the same way? You know, personally, I grew up with some kids where if there was even a slight hint of punishment, they shaped up and were obedient right away. And There's also plenty of kids who responded to punishment, but responded fairly slowly, and they were going to need several rounds of punishment for their behavior to change. And some kids where punishment wasn't terribly effective, and some kids where punishing them just pissed them off and got worse behavior out of them. Maybe punishment is one possible way to try to get a kid to be good rather than the one way to get a kid to be good. In my neck of the woods, it was real important to be respected. And the assumption was the way you get respect is to intimidate somebody. The way you get respect is to beat somebody up. I'm not sure that is actually respect, but I guess you get treated as though you're respected if you intimidate people enough. And one of the things that easily gets dysfunctional about these behavioral strategies, A, this is all happening on the automatic level, so we're not particularly noticing this and doing quality control. But if I use my normal strategy and it doesn't work, what happens? If humans were wise, rational beings, they would stop and say, gee, that didn't work, what else could I do? But that's not usually the way humans react. The way humans usually react is by trying hard. If I punish the kid and this doesn't result in them immediately shaping up, then I punish them more vigorously. I punish them more frequently. I punish them more intensely. And if that doesn't work, I take it up a notch. And if that doesn't work, I take it up a notch. And it can take humans a heck of a long time to register that what I'm doing is not working. Maybe I should try a different approach. And when we're talking about anger, the should in there injects moral overtones. And it makes it feel like the other party is being bad. And if somebody's bad, they should be punished. And we should punish them until they start being good. And so, that often plays an important role in dysfunctional interactions. We've also got the metacognitive level, if you want to sound fancy. Our thoughts about our thoughts and feelings. You get, a classic example is kid grows up with a parent who has a bad temper. And as a kid, they decide, oh my God, I don't want to be like that. When I grow up, I'm not going to be like that. And so they go through life trying not to be angry and telling themselves they shouldn't be angry and telling themselves they shouldn't lose their temper, which doesn't turn out to be a very effective way of managing not to be angry. It's not a very effective way of handling anger well. It's not a very effective way of, keeping cool. It results in the person, not only do they lose their temper, but now they're mad at themselves that they lost their temper, which complicates things rather than improving things. Taking a look at a concrete example, this is one stolen from Beck's book on anger. On the top of page 3, we've got one particular example. This is from a couple. Guy is cranking through life, minding his own business, and his wife criticizes something he did. His interpretation is, she thinks I'm a nobody. Okay, that's a pretty loaded interpretation. That's going to generate a pretty strong reaction. In his case, he feels belittled, weak, hurt, and feels like he's being victimized. That results in him getting angry about being mistreated and an impulse to punish her. And then he has some disinhibiting cognition, some permission-giving cognition. She deserves it. She's asking for it. And in this particular occasion, he ends up punching her. And one thing that's handy to notice here is actually, in the chain of events, anger isn't the first reaction. In this case, he feels hurt, and then his anger is a reaction to that. Some people go, non-cognitive behavioral people, go so far as to argue that anger is always a reaction to feeling hurt, vulnerable, etc. You know, I don't know what planet they live on. You know, there are plenty of times when people are indeed angry as a reaction to feeling hurt, vulnerable, etc. There are also plenty of times when people are just mad because they feel like they're being mistreated or things are unfair or things are unjustified. But certainly, one thing to keep in mind is that whatever reaction I'm having at the moment may be a reaction to other stuff going on within me. How's all this sound so far? So, in terms of working with a given individual, one of the things we're going to want to do is do an assessment and figure out what's going on with this person. How come, why is this person having problems with anger? And the good old approach of taking specific problem situations one at a time and finding out what happened, what led up to it, what they were feeling, what thoughts ran through their head, what they did, how did the other person react to that. Turns out to be a pretty useful way to sort this stuff out. Let's go to the videotape for a moment. The therapist here is Chris Fedeschi from Newport Beach. Doing some guided discovery with an angry client.
So let's see how the credit dialogue might look with an angry client. Tell me what happened at the lunch club.
One of my co-workers, Charlie, and I planned to have lunch together. He said he'd meet me at noon. And I was at my desk, and noon he didn't show up. And I waited. And finally, 20 after 12, he showed up. And I said, what's the matter, Charlie? And he said, he told me the boss had cornered him, and Bob asked about the project. And I said, Charlie, there's work time and there's personal time. You tell the man that when it's lunch time, it's your time. Now we don't have any time for lunch. I just lost it.
You
were
really into it.
Yeah.
Now, what was going on in the 20 minutes before we actually showed up?
And before we get into that, one of the things I'm noticing as I just listened to this a little bit so far is he's given us a sample of how he would deal with this situation, or at least he thinks he would tell the boss off if it's lunchtime and the boss wants to talk to him. And I can, think about what do I already know from, the initial evaluation and the presenting information and so on. And, this may give us a good snapshot of how the guy actually does handle anger and conflict, and with the average boss, that's not going to play out terribly well. Or it may turn out that his image of how Charlie should handle things is actually not what he ends up doing in real life, and he hasn't noticed that his expectations for Charlie don't match what he actually does in real life. In addition to, listening to what the guy's got to say about his thoughts and feelings, I'm also paying attention to what he has to say about his behavior and also how his interaction with me sheds light on how he handles anger and conflict.
He just forgot. People seem to do that a lot. I don't get a lot of attention around here.
You think the people at work forget you a lot?
They don't seem to know what I do or what I've done for the company there. They come to me if they want something done, but otherwise,
So first you thought he'd forgotten, and it kind of showed that he wasn't counting you as very important.
And so he's attaching some meanings to Charlie's behavior. Charlie's 20 minutes late. This must show that I'm not important to Charlie. Now, I also notice he's got some expectations here. He's saying, people at work come to me when they want me to do something and they don't otherwise, with as though it's not supposed to be that way. Wait a minute. Are people at work supposed to seek me out to pat me on the back when there's nothing work-related for me to do? I'm not sure what his image is of how he should be treated at work. But it sounds like he's not treating it as though this is a job. It's as though, you know, people have some social obligations to him. And I'm willing to bet that his co-workers have no idea that this is what he expects of them. In fact, my bet is his co-workers think that going to him when they need him to do something and leaving him alone to do his job when they don't need to bother him, I'm willing to bet they think that's completely appropriate and might be inclined to figure that they shouldn't bother him when they don't need to.
Who's Charlie? Is his co-worker?
His co-worker who was 20 minutes late meeting him for lunch.
Is his, like, superior?
No, a co-worker at the same level.
Does it have something else to do or forgotten? Or of course, he did show up.
Mm-hmm.
But I told him that, you know, if he lets them do that, they're just going to walk all over him. Happens to me.
So when you were sitting there in that 20 minutes, I want to really focus on that time frame before Charlie showed up for the luncheon date. First, you thought he forgot, and when you thought that, how were you feeling? Were you feeling upset or sad?
I was burned up about that. The man made a date for lunch. I wanted to talk to him about something, and I just thought he was ignoring it.
Mm-hmm. So what did that mean?
I felt angry.
What did you think he was saying about you by ignoring the lunch?
Obviously, I wasn't that important. Mm-hmm. Else to do.
Mm-hmm. So that feels pretty lousy when we're sitting there, we're thinking, well, they're not considering me important. They're just shining the lunch on. And so then you started getting more and more angry about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And another thing I noticed is just a minute ago, he said in reference to Charlie, you know, if you let him get away with that, he'll keep taking advantage of you. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that captures an important assumption he operates on. If he lets Charlie get away with being 20 minutes late, he anticipates Charlie mistreating him in the future. And, you know, my bet is that this explains a lot of his issues with his co-workers, you know, that he's been treating his co-workers as though he'd better not let anybody get away with anything or he'll be treated badly in the future. And he sounds like he's fairly oblivious to the actual impact he has on his co-workers and the ways they actually respond to his words and actions.
I believe when he
finally did that. So did you find over this 20 minutes you got more and more angry as time went by?
Yeah.
Did it ever occur to you that anything else might have happened besides he just forgot about you?
I knew he was there. I'd seen him earlier in the day.
So then you said when he did get there, you kind of blew up at him.
Yeah, I just felt that he should have kept his appointment. He had an excuse, but I didn't think it was a really good excuse. He should have stood his ground.
Mm-hmm. And the excuse was that the boss had cornered him and talked to him for a while. And what did Charlie say when you said, there's personal time and work time and you shouldn't
go? He said something about, well, he couldn't really tell the boss to wait. I don't know why. I think he could.
Mm-hmm. That would have been something you would have
done. Yeah.
And just as a quick aside, why is Charlie the one person at this company who's willing to have lunch with the client here? Because Charlie's got his own issue. Charlie can't stand up to the boss. Charlie can't stand up to this yahoo. And it's not by accident that people end up finding their way into the relationships they find themselves in.
Tell the boss, hey, I've got a lunch in the morning.
Well, that's been a long time. Sure, I could tell them that I have made this
Would your boss handle that for you, okay?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. How about Charlie? Is Charlie pretty assertive with other people at the office? Do you think he was telling the truth when he said...
I think that's just the way Charlie is. I think a little too easygoing, and people impose on him.
And in this case, he let the boss impose on him, and that then imposed on you too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you didn't get lunch that day.
Right. Yeah. There just wasn't time.
Yeah. And it's interesting to notice that he's saying, "Well, that's just the way Charlie is," but he's also was angry at Charlie. And one thing that comes up a lot in relationships and gets talked about a fair amount in cognitive behavioral marital therapy is people often invest a lot of time and energy in being angry at the other person for being the way they are, which usually ends up not to be terribly productive. But one of the things that's easy to pick up in the course of growing up is a gut sense that if I don't like the way things are, the thing to do is to get upset about it, and that's supposed to fix it. And thinking back to when I was a kid growing up, what happened when the people around me didn't like the way things were? They got upset. And that was supposed to get me to turn in my homework on time, take out the trash when I was supposed to, obey the rules, etc. And so it's easy to pick up from those experiences the idea that the thing to do when you don't like the way things are is to get upset about it. And it's also a strategy that works sometimes. You know, if I order a cheeseburger for lunch and they bring me a chef salad, if I get upset about it, they'll take away the salad and bring me my cheeseburger. And so if it works, it seems like I'd better keep it up. The times when I try it and it doesn't work, it seems like maybe I didn't do a good enough job. I should try harder next time. I should be more upset the next time. And often people don't get around to considering other alternatives. If you stop and think about it, if I order a cheeseburger and they bring me a chef salad, getting upset is an option that might well work. It's also not the only I could ask nicely. That probably would work too. You know, I could choose to patronize a restaurant that serves me what I order. You know, that probably would work too. But a lot of people get just locked into dealing with things in their usual way and don't even consider alternatives. And so, you know, people can get really locked into being upset at their spouse, their boss, their coworker for being the way they are. And the unspoken assumption is this is supposed to make the other person, if I'm upset at Charlie for not standing up to the boss, this is supposed to result in Charlie being more assertive next time. If I get upset at my spouse for losing something, this is supposed to result in them not losing it the next time, etc. I mean, the classic from, you know, 50s TV shows is the wife dings the car and the husband gets mad at her, and this is supposed to result in her not having fender benders in the future. Wait a minute. Did she have the fender bender voluntarily because she thought it was a fine idea?
The whole thing
was just kind of a fiasco from your point of view. And then
how did things work out with Charlie?
Oh, well,
Charlie said that, or you said that?
I said that.
Did you mean it?
Well, yeah. Charlie's one of the few people who are still around here that I have relations with.
One thing that concerns me, Carl, is when you were sitting there waiting for that 20 minutes. It sounds like that was so uncomfortable. In fact, I can see when you're sitting here telling me about it, you're pretty wound up and tight.
Yeah.
And I imagine that doesn't feel very good inside.
No, it doesn't. It makes me feel uncomfortable. It always makes me feel like that when I feel that somebody's taking advantage of or dismissing me.
I'm going to write those two things down. Those are good words. So you felt like Charlie was taking advantage of you and also dismissing you. And those are real key triggers for you.
I realize I wasn't really dismissing that. He had this thing with the boss, but still.
And one thing to notice is Chris simply repeats back to him what he told her, and I'd like, oh, this sounds important, and his response to say, well, actually, Charlie wasn't really dismissing me. That since a lot of this is going on in our heads, and we're not really paying attention, we're not noticing, you know, fully the thoughts and feelings,
we don't get a chance to do quality control. And so a lot of this stuff, it turns out to be fairly easy targets, and some of it persists just because it hasn't been exposed to the light of day. You repeat back to the client, well, so you were thinking, if I, let them get away with any of this, then they'll be taking advantage of me all the time. And the client says, oh, yeah, that is a little extreme. These people aren't actually that bad, etc. Another thing to notice is that Chris is doing a lot of being empathic and understanding and nodding and so on, particularly with angry people. The client is probably going to be angry to some extent while they're telling me about this stuff. And, hey, Carl really reacts strongly if he feels like somebody's being dismissive. If it came across as Chris was not taking him seriously or was reacting like he was being an idiot or was looking down on him or being critical of him, that would probably result in Carl being pissed at Chris. And also, it's not terribly conducive to maintaining a collaborative relationship. So I want to make a point of being empathic and understanding and looking at things from the client's perspective at the same time as I'm noticing, points for intervention down the road. And also, when we're doing the examining the evidence, etc., I want to do that in an understanding, respectful way. I want to be careful that it doesn't sound like I'm, disrespecting them, demeaning them, etc. Because I don't really need more clients mad at me. It happens enough anyway.
Well, and in particular, in that 20 minutes you were waiting, you didn't know that anything was going on with the boss, so you were pretty sure then that he was taking advantage of you or dismissing you.
That was my assumption.
He was dismissing you, Mr. And when you had that assumption, what did that do to you?
Make me angry.
Did you get angry and tight?
Yeah.
Physically tight? Did you have any uncomfortable physical symptoms?
Sort of a tightness in my body.
Mm-hmm.
As if I wasn't breathing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, of course, what would have been ideal is if he showed up on time. That would have been good.
But
that doesn't always happen. And so I'm wondering, when people don't show up on time, how would you like to handle it so that you don't have to be so uncomfortable? What would you like it to be like for you when you're waiting for someone?
Oh, I guess I'd like to give them a little more slack and assume that maybe there's some reason.
Why would you like to do that?
I just don't like to fly off the handle like that. If I thought there was some real reason for it being late, I guess I would have contained it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And do you think you would have felt better also yourself during that 20 minutes? Like if you'd known there was something going on, you wouldn't have been there for a while. Okay. So that might be something then for us to try to figure out is how you can, in those situations where you start thinking they're dismissing me, they're taking advantage of me, how you can maybe generate some other thoughts or some other things to say to yourself to explain the situation until you find out what the real situation is. So it's possible you'll find out someone really was taking advantage of you or dismissing you, and then it might be appropriate to feel angry. Or you might find out something else is going on, in which case it might be nice for you to be able to be less wound up during that 20 minutes, because I can really see how distressing that was. Would you be willing to work on that?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, Carl, I want to summarize then what we've been talking about here. We've been talking about the kinds of assumptions and ideas that go through your head when you're waiting for someone. And it sounds like one set of assumptions that went through your head in this instance with Charlie is he's dismissing me, taking advantage of me, I'm not important. If those kinds of interpretations are going through your mind, you feel how?
Well, I feel angry and annoyed. I feel that way. gotten faster paced around there. People don't seem to be the kind of day.
So even this idea of being unimportant to the other people there, that really fuels your sense of tension.
Yeah, I just don't feel that people appreciate very much what I do.
And you suggested a different kind of thought you could have when someone's late for a meeting with you. Do you remember what that was?
Well, yeah, I suppose I should just give the benefit of the doubt and wait and see what happens.
Maybe there's a good reason. I'll find out when they get here. And if you had that kind of thought when you were waiting, how do you imagine you'd feel?
Or I might still be a little annoyed, but I guess I wouldn't get so angry about it.
Mm-hmm. And you, in addition to not getting angry, it sounds like you also might feel better about yourself, because you might feel less like they're treating you.
Yeah, I wouldn't get so worked up.
Okay. So maybe we could spend some more time today then talking about these different thoughts that go through your mind when you're in situations like this. The impact it has on you physically and in terms of how you feel, so that you get better at making choices about how you want to look at situations for your own benefit. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
And this chunk, Chris is focusing on the cognitive level of things, and it seems to be going well and being useful. If you stop and think about it, this is not the only possible line of intervention. For example, Carl is sitting there for 20 minutes getting more and more worked up about Charlie being late. What could Carl do rather than sit and fume? The odds are he's got a phone and Charlie's got a phone. And when it's clear to him that Charlie is running late, he could give Charlie a call and find out what's going on. You know, and sometimes there are simple, obvious solutions that in the heat of the moment, the client just overlooks and doesn't even consider. Now, also, if I am mad at Charlie, I could just blast him when he finally shows up. And in the long run, is that going to encourage Charlie to go to lunch with me, or is it going to scare Charlie off from going to lunch with me? Or I could express myself in somewhat different ways. I could conceivably see about letting Charlie know I don't appreciate his being late in a calm, reasonable way. And that might play out differently. That might get a different reaction from Charlie. And certainly, it sounds like this guy's got a bunch of coworkers where interacting with them differently would result in a somewhat different relationship that he would like better. How's all that sound? Yeah?
I was just thinking, I felt Chris was spending so much time talking about kind of how he felt, what's going through. Felt like it was like repeat. Is that for demonstration purposes? This is how you do it.
It depends on what point of therapy are we at and what do we need to accomplish. This is relatively early in therapy, where part of what Chris is doing is trying to understand what problems are going on, but at the same time she's trying to help Carl understand the relationship between thoughts and feelings. And to check in and make sure he's getting the message, he's understanding this. So it's partly she's trying to pace things so that she won't be too far ahead of Carl. She wants to pace it in manageable steps so it'll make sense to him. She's highlighting the connection between thoughts and feelings because I think this is supposed to be like the third session. And actually, I don't remember if Carl is an actual client at this stage in therapy or if this is a dramatic recreation, if it's good, whichever way it is. But, if I'm working with somebody who doesn't yet see the connection between thoughts and feelings, then I need to take the time to highlight, aha, you were thinking X, how did you feel? Oh, is there a connection there? Two sessions later, I don't need to take the time to do that because we've covered it
2 weeks ago, we covered it last week, the client now sees the connection between their thoughts and feelings. So the pacing will vary depending on where we are in therapy, whether what we're on today is easy for the client to grasp or hard for the client to grasp. Is this somebody who catches on quickly or catches on slowly? So on. I think this is a pretty ordinary pacing for relatively early in therapy. Now, I think Chris also is making an effort to be particularly clear because he's trying to give a good example for in a training video. And also, I think this is Chris's personal style. So there's all of that. Other questions, comments? Now, in, you know, walking through problem situations one at a time and developing an understanding of what's going on, you know, I could just with each client start from scratch and figure things out from a blank slate. That's more work than if there are some patterns that come up frequently enough, so I want to watch for them and say, aha, this is what's going on this occasion. You know, that gives, you know, it's just like we have our handy-dandy cognitive model of OCD or borderline personality disorder. It's not that everybody is exactly standard, but that gives me a head start in individualizing treatment. And with anger, there are a number of patterns that come up pretty frequently. One of them is at the bottom of page 3. Which I've got labeled the anger suppression cycle. You know, in this case, you know, somebody treats me in a way I don't appreciate. We get the intrusion on personal domain. Let's imagine on this occasion, my coworker is sitting at their desk, absentmindedly tapping their finger on the desk. And that happens to be getting on my nerves. If it seems unreasonable, unjustified, if I'm, you know, generally, they always do this, etc., that'll amplify the aggravation, you know. And so I'm feeling some degree of irritation, aggravation, annoyance, anger. And I've got some options. You know, one option is I might express it clearly and directly. You idiot, quit doing that. And if I do that and they stop, problem is solved. It may not be the ideal way to handle the situation, but if it works, it works. A lot of people along the way have, you know, picked up the idea that yelling at people when I'm mad at them generally doesn't go over so well. And so this is getting on my nerves. It's being aggravating, but I hold it in. I don't say anything about it. If my coworker is tapping their finger and it's getting on my nerves and I don't say anything about it, what's going to happen? Well, first of all things being equal, they're probably going to keep tapping their finger on the desk because they don't know it's bothering me. And the longer they tap their finger on the desk, the more aggravated I'm going to get. Now, if it's just one little aggravation, you know, and they spend a while being aggravated. Sooner or later, they stop tapping their finger. They, you know, go to get a cup of coffee. I go to get a cup of coffee. Something happens. The situation is resolved. And if there's just the one aggravation, it may well just fade away. No problem other than me having spent a little time being more aggravated than necessary. But often in life, events don't cooperate. You know, if, you know, first thing this morning I went to have my breakfast and I discovered that somebody used the last of the milk and didn't put it on the shopping list, I'm a little aggravated. And then I discovered they left their dishes on the counter rather than putting them in the sink, and I'm a little more aggravated. And then I pull onto 480 and traffic is backed up, and I'm more aggravated. And then my coworker is tapping their finger on the desk. And this is a lot more aggravating than it would be otherwise. Remember, moods bias cognition in mood congruent ways. You know, if I'm depressed, I tend to be pessimistic and easily discouraged and so on. If I'm anxious, I tend to be on the lookout for danger and quick to overreact to stuff. If I'm aggravated, I tend to be on the lookout for being mistreated by others and tend to take it more seriously and react more strongly to it. So if I come into this already aggravated,
then it's likely to bug me more. And if I don't handle the situation in a way that resolves things, then something else aggravating may well happen, and some other aggravating thing may well happen. And eventually, I'll have all that I can take. One more annoying thing happens, and I go nuclear over it. And this has assorted repercussions. A, I'm saying and doing things that I later regret. B, to the whoever I go nuclear on, it seems like I'm dramatically overreacting to what they did. They react to my anger, however, you know, maybe they're mad at me now, maybe they're terribly hurt, maybe I've been fired, you know, whatever repercussions happen. And then I look at what happened, and I say, oh my God, my anger is terrible, I have to control my temper, by which I mean suppress my anger, which just perpetuates the cycle, because I don't have the perspective to register. The problem isn't that I was angry. The problem isn't that I expressed anger. The problem is that I held things in as long as possible and then went nuclear over something small. And this is a problem, a pattern that comes up a lot in my practice. And so when I'm walking through specific problem situations looking to see what's going on, I want to pay attention to, aha, is this somebody who suppresses anger as long as possible and then blows up? And hey, there's an element of that in what Carl was doing. We have that 20 minutes of fuming over Charlie being late, and then he yells at Charlie when Charlie finally shows up. From just looking at one situation, I don't know if this is characteristic of Carl or not. It wouldn't surprise me at all if it turned out to be characteristic of him, but I can find out easily. We just take another situation and walk through what led up to it, thoughts and feelings, etc. By the time we've looked at two or three situations, it's going to be pretty obvious if this is somebody who, you know, pretty consistently tends to suppress anger as long as possible and then overreact. And when we get to interventions, I've got a game plan in mind that fits that situation. Another scenario that comes up a lot is on page 4. This is stolen from Barclay, and it's called the coercive behavior cycle. And this is the classic, you know, the assumption we're operating on. You know, Barclay talks about it in terms of parents dealing with kids. And we got the idea that a way to get a kid to be good is punish them when they're bad. Simple, straightforward, commonplace assumption. That means I need to be on the lookout for a bad behavior so that I can spot it and punish it. And one side effect it has is we humans have limited brain capacity. If I'm paying attention to one thing, I'm not paying as much attention to other stuff. If I go through my day on the lookout for bad behavior, I'm not being equally vigilant for neutral behavior and good behavior. And I'm going to end up with a somewhat more negative view of the kid than is realistic, because I'm watching for bad behavior, I'm not watching for good behavior. And so I spot a higher proportion of the bad stuff that happens than of the good stuff that happens. And the other part of it is, when I spot the kid doing something bad, I punish them. In my worldview, this is supposed to result in them not doing it again. If it works, no problem. The kid quits doing whatever I caught them doing, and I'm no longer being so vigilant for bad behavior. The kid's not doing whatever upset me. It may not be ideal, but it works well enough to get by. However, on the occasions where punishment doesn't work, then I find myself trying harder. I'm more on the lookout for bad behavior. I'm quicker to punish. I punish more intensely. I punish more angrily. And the more persistently I'm on the lookout for bad behavior, the more bad behavior I spot, the less good behavior I spot. And more I get a skewed vision of this kid, the more and more it seems like I'm dealing with a bad kid. When I punish the kid and it doesn't work, well, in my worldview, punishment should work. It's not working. It ends up feeling like the kid is being bad by not responding to punishment. And I often end up being mad at the kid because punishment is being ineffective. as though it was the kid's fault that punishment is being ineffective. And, you know, we humans can get locked into trying harder and harder and harder, not registering this is not working, and get you to try a different approach. Now, at the same time, imagine you're the kid in this situation. You know, if you break a rule and get punished, you don't like it, but actually, to most kids, that seems fairly reasonable and justified. This is what adults are supposed to do when I break a rule. But if the parent in question is watching for bad behavior and noticing my bad behavior and not giving me any credit for my good behavior, if they're getting more and more wound up and they're overreacting to stuff, if the consequences seem out of proportion with the transgression, etc., it starts seeming unreasonable, unfair, unjustified. And if you're being treated worse than you deserve, how does that feel to you? It don't feel good. You know, you feel like you're being treated badly. You may well find yourself getting angry at the person who's treating you badly. You know, if you feel like you're being treated unfairly, being treated badly, you're getting angry at this person, does that predispose you to being nice and kind and obedient? No, the more pissed you are at the parent, the less inclined you are to do what they want you to do. You know, depending on your personality, you may find yourself intentionally doing stuff to piss them off. Or you might find yourself just standing your ground and refusing to give in. And anyway, once things go too far, the excessive punishment not only is ineffective, but it can start being counterproductive. Also, what is the kid hearing from the parent? They're hearing about all their transgressions. They're hearing about all the bad stuff they've done. They also may well be hearing about how much of a bad kid they are and how inappropriate they are and how everybody else would think they were a terrible person if they only knew, etc. And this can lead to the kid getting more and more of a negative view of themselves. A big chunk of how we form our image of ourselves is what we hear from those around us. Suppose my parent succeeds in convincing me that I'm a bad kid. Is that going to predispose me to do good stuff? Well, no. Bad kids don't do good stuff. Bad kids do bad stuff. And if the parent succeeds in convincing me that I'm a bad kid, that may result in less good behavior rather than improving my behavior. And, you know, this is a pattern. It can get pretty entrenched, and it's not necessarily easy to break people out of. And I've given the parent-child example because that's where Barclay developed this model. But the same thing can happen exactly the same way in employer-employee relationships and in husband-wife relationships and in all sorts of relationships, you know, particularly if there's a power differential. You know, so this is another common pattern I keep my eyes open for. Questions, comments, reactions? Okay, at this point, let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll get to what we actually do about this stuff.